This episode is brought to you by Just Egg. You can't have plant-based breakfast without a plant-based egg. You can get started with a free sample. Just head to ju.st/hrn.
With our growing season just around the corner, we're sowing seeds of knowledge and empathy on this week's episode of Meat and Three through four unique stories.
I'm always shocked at how aggressive people are with their language. They'll have something like Japanese knotweed and they'll say, you know, these are terrible, they're foreigners, they're invasive, and you know, but they're also, you know, they're really healthy if you eat them.
We're surrounded by seeds that have already adapted to live with us, and they're actually already kind of living in the future because cities are hotter and they're more polluted and they're more fragmented, and these are the plants that can deal with that.
Tune in to Meat and Three, available wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Cooking Issues. This is Dave Arnold, your host of Cooking Issues, coming to you live on the Heritage Radio Network, like from whenever to whenever, Heritage Radio Network. I am joined by myself in the Lower East Side of Manhattan. We got Nastasia back in New York. How you doing, Nastasia?
Great.
Or Connecticut.
Great.
Yeah, you doing all right?
Yeah.
You enjoying the sweet, sweet freezing weather we just got for a day?
Yeah, why would anyone want to be anywhere else?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm glad that you're your usual sunny self. That's awesome. John, back from his grand jury duty. How you doing, John?
Doing great, thanks.
You got your fill of watching murders and kidnappings on videotape, have you?
Yeah.
Faith in humanity restored.
Yeah.
He's ready for Cooking Issues to come and bring him back down.
Yeah, you said it was like horrific, right? In terms of like what you're exposed to on the daily?
Yeah, it's pretty crazy the crimes that, you know, happen in the city and in such like popular places right in the middle of the day. It was a sobering.
We got Matt in his you're permanently Rhode Island Heidi hold, right?
Yeah. Doing it.
Yeah. All right. So if we have time, which we won't, because we have like a panoply of amazing guests today, but I have more updates on the vacuuming bread trials, but we probably won't have time. So I'm going to get right into it today. We have three special guests. First, longtime, coming on the show, friend of the show, Ariel Johnson, Dr. Ariel Johnson, flavor chemist. How do you like to describe yourself right now, Ariel? What's your favorite? Like author,
besides about to be failed author. No, I'm joking. I usually say I'm a flavor scientist or a food scientist.
Flavor scientist. I like that. But like not like a, most people who are flavor scientists are more.
Or they're flavorists. I think flavor scientist might be a title that I invented. I'm not sure, but I think it best encompasses what
right. You know how to use technology, but you're not a technologist.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I can pretend to be one, but mostly my my job is to study and talk about flavor.
Yeah, well, welcome back. It's good.
Thanks
to,
for
good
having
to,
me.
Yeah, good to hear you. Good to hear. And also, you might know her also now as Good Eats Chief Science Officer, which is also a good title. Did you come up with that?
No, I didn't. I think Alton, like many of us, likes Star Trek, and I believe that's either the same or close to Spock's designation on the Enterprise. So I'm not complaining about that, certainly.
Yeah, you were a pro Nimoy.
Oh, sure. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, where do you fall on the George Takei, William Shatner spectrum?
I mean, how can you really choose? But I think I'm more of a Takei person.
Yeah. So you don't like the All right. Well, we can't.
It's
we
not
can't
that
spend
I don't
all...
like it.
All right. And, of course, also longtime friend, Harold McGee on the line. How you doing, Harold?
I'm very well, thanks. How about you guys?
Doing all right. So the last time we had on was, you know, unfortunately for Maria Guarnaschelli's memorial show. But then also we had you on about your new book, Nosedive. How's that going? Going well, I hope.
Yeah, it's now new-ish, but doing pretty well, getting some good reviews and... And so we'll see about sales.
Yeah. Well, you know, whatever. So the reason I have you two on is because we've gotten a lot of questions recently on COVID and olfaction, right? So, I mean, everyone's thinking about COVID all the time. But a lot of people, especially for cooking and in this show in particular, you know, they're asking, well, look, you know, I've lost my sense of taste or my sense of smell because of COVID. And, you know, what can I do about it? Is it permanent? Is there any way to cook around it, et cetera, et cetera? So I thought, you know, the two of you would be perfect for the show, especially because, Harold, I'm allowed to say that you had anosmia as a result, like, years ago, right? Or no?
Yes.
I mean, it's too late. Yeah. I already said it. Yeah. We could have cut it out. But, yeah, Harold also has an interesting perspective because he is a food guy author who also suffered from anosmia, which means lack of smell. We'll get into the technical stuff later. But I brought a special other guest who's his first time. I've known him for like probably 30 years or something, but it's his first time on the program. Live from Harvard, we have Sandeep Robert Datta, who will now be called Bob, because that's what I've called him since I've known him. But he is an olfactory scientist at the Harvard, at the best lab name ever. What's the name of your lab, Bob?
The Data Lab.
How sweet is that? Because it produces data, and his name is Data. How sick is that? Is that the best name for a lab that's ever happened? Ariel, what do you think about that?
That is quite the serendipitous name, definitely.
Yeah, and just so you guys get a feel for kind of who Bob is, so like, am I allowed to say almost anything about you or not, Bob? I mean, you're pretty like—
Go for it, man. Go for it. It's all you.
So like, you know, so I actually know Bob through his wife, Eliza, because Eliza and I were friends in college. Turns out I went to college with Bob, but I didn't know it at the time. Anyway, so like we became friends later, and especially because I found out he was a big food guy, not just an MD, PhD with his own lab at Harvard, because he didn't have that at the time. But he used to throw a yearly party. Instead of a birthday, he would have an I'm not dead party. And this is how I learned about Bob's kind of love of food, because every year he would have this blowout crazy party where he would cook for days and invite people in to celebrate the fact that he was not dead, right?
Right. Still not. Yeah.
Still not dead. Well, because he had a particularly horrible like medical procedure and, you know, problem that, it, you know, could have gone either. Let's just say it could have gone either way. Right, Bob?
Yeah. Thankfully didn't.
Yeah, yeah. So we'll have him back on again. If you guys ever want to know about the perils of not paying your cryo bill, like Bob's story on not paying your cryo bill will put you in tears. We'll put you in tears.
No matter how badly off you are, you should always check your mail. That's my advice.
Especially if you have important stuff in a deep freezer somewhere.
Oh, no.
You might want to... All's well that ends well. It turns out that the people who were threatening to turn off the switch on Bob's cryogenic stored products also was lazy. And so all's well that ended well on that one. Also, a little known fact about Bob, Bob went to high school with Snoop Dogg.
True that.
Yeah. Wait, did you grow up in Long Beach or what?
Yeah, I grew up in a town next to Long Beach called Lakewood. So I basically am, I kicked around the LBC all while growing up, basically.
Yeah.
I didn't tell you this. We just had our high school reunion. Snoop Dogg threw the after party. And I got to tell you, it was exactly. You know, Snoop Dogg came, Slick Rick came, Color Me Bad. Remember? Want to sex you up. Remember?
Oh, yeah.
It was incredible.
It sounds incredible. See, I'm just trying to give you guys a flavor for who's going to be talking to you. All right. One last thing I'll give, and this is the Cooking Issues crowd especially will like this. You told me a story once that like you were at your house, you were a small child, your grandma came over, I think it was your grandma, came over to your house and was like, what's wrong with you? And the first thing she did is, to your parents, what's wrong with you, is she dug a hole in the ground and built a tandoor. True or false? This is what you told me.
100% true. And that was the best food I've ever eaten. She dug the clay out of our backyard. She was in her 70s, hand-built a tandoor and just killed it for the entire time she was living with us. It was an incredible.
I mean, that's like Grandma Plus Plus right there.
Grandma Plus Plus.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, nice. Well, because what region was she from originally?
From the Punjab.
Nice. Anyways, all right, that's enough of pre-stuff. Now we're going to give a word of warning. Since we have three people who... like know all the fancy words, let's try to stay away from some word salad when we're talking about this stuff. All right, let's keep it on the normal. Like I'll give you an example. I was reading an interview in advance of this that Bob gave to one of his Harvard cronies over there, and they were talking about COVID and smell, right? And he's giving kind of a normal interview, like, you know, hey, beep, beep, boop, boop, and he's like, you know what? Sustentacular cells, they're more important than you think. It's kind of like they're like, you know, like glial cell important. And I'm like, No. First of all, I don't want to hear anyone say sustentacular unless they're saying, how you's doing? Hey, sustentacular. Like, for those of you that aren't hip to sustentacular, as I was not, you know, before, you know, not before 8 a.m. this morning, you could just say support cell. There doesn't need to be a word sustentacular where you take, I don't know, tacular and add it to sustain and get sustentacular. What the heck is it with that word?
They're spectacular cells that sustain things.
They're freaking, like, spectacular. Like, how high was the scientist who came up with that name when they did? But,
well, you know, I think they were first named, you know, they were first named sustentasing, right? And that didn't work out so well.
Oh my God, sustentacular. Oh my God, such a word salad. All right, so the one, like, so we'll just get it straight. Are we going to use anosmia, parosmia, that word that means I can't taste? What's that one?
Well, that would be agusia, if you can't taste. Yeah. But anosmia is you can't smell, and parosmia is you can smell, but it's messed up.
All right. Now, I got Bob on not just because he's an olfactory scientist. And by the way, Bob spent many years seeing, like, whether he could look at images of rats shrugging and then figure out what was going on in their brain with a camera, right, with a visual camera and then a camera that looked inside their actual brain while they were alive and wow. developed a microscope to do this. Is this a true story or am I making this up?
No, this is a true story. That work is ongoing and it's pretty cool. I'll tell you about it later.
One more thing before we get into it, because that's, again, the flavor. I like to tie this back to things, even people who haven't had the COVID. Here's some career advice from what Bob did as a younger researcher that I think is great career advice. I think, Ariel, you're especially going to enjoy this. So he went to work for a famous person's lab at Columbia University for – it was postdoc, right, Bob?
Yep.
All right. So he's doing his postdoc for – and so he convinces this guy to build a fantastically expensive new microscope. And the name of the microscope, what is it, two-photon microscope?
It's a multi-photon microscope, exactly.
Yeah. And so how much did that sucker cost?
Laser to power was $250,000.
Okay. So, and that was, hey, folks, that's just the laser. We're not talking about, like, the optics.
The light bulb, it's $250,000 for the light.
Yeah. So anyway, so we're talking like lots of money, not to mention like, you know, all the rats that Bob was going through left and right. By the way, no illegal way to kill a rat in New York City. Anyway, so what he did, and this is the genius for all of you growing up. I know that a lot of people who are, when they're younger, they're worried that they're going to go work for someone, like for us, it's probably in a restaurant or in hospitality, and they're going to give all their good ideas to the person who's getting all the credit. Right, Bob did the reverse. He gave his all. He built like a great microscope, but since no one had built them before, he learned a lot about building this particular kind of microscope with somebody else's $1 million. Right, became the guy who knew how to build the $1 million microscope, and then got to build one that was like twice as good when he moved over to Harvard and got his own lab. So this is good career advice. Am I right, Bob?
It's good career advice. Always spending someone else's money is good advice.
Spend someone else's money first. Don't worry about giving up the idea. Instead, learn on somebody else's nickel and then become the heavyweight. No?
Easy peasy.
Yeah.
That is great.
You like that, Ariel? I thought, Ariel, you
liked
that.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's there's also the skill in finding someone who will give you that money. And until then, what I've usually done is built things out of garbage and scrap and then been the first person to,
well,
to use,
you know,
those things.
Ariel and I have a secret business idea that I think that mm-hmm. Nastasia and John know about, to build something out of garbage for people. But, you know, it should be fun.
You've been very patient about my my ever-extending book deadline, but yes, we'll
oh,
do that.
I'm familiar with ever-extending book deadlines. So anyway, so none of those reasons is the reason that Bob's on the show. It's not shrugging rats, although I'm sure it's related, but... Bob and a number of people in his lab last March 2020, were some of the first people to realize that people who were getting COVID in the first outbreak were having problems with olfaction and did some of the early research. So you want to talk about what? Ooh, nice, Bob. You want to talk about what you learned and what you know?
Yeah, sure. So let me start by saying we still haven't figured it out. So it's been a year into the pandemic, and I think a bunch of us are still wondering and still working on this problem, which is a big problem, I think even bigger than we realized. So just to kind of step back and talk about some numbers briefly, I'd say the most recent data suggests that if you get COVID, about 80% of you are gonna have a change in your sense of smell. Some of you lose entirely, for some of you, you'll lose partially, but like, you know, the vast majority of people who go ahead and get COVID get some sort of anosmia or parosmia, a loss of their smell or a diminution in their sense of smell. And then of those, you know, for most people, it comes back pretty quick, 2 to 4 weeks usually. But there's definitely a bunch of people, 30% maybe, who go on for longer. And so, you know, I think what that means, right, is that there are millions of people now across the globe who are kind of dealing with this as an issue. And so as a consequence, a bunch of us are trying pretty hard to figure out what's going on. And I think, you know, as I said, we still don't know, but I think the ideas we have now kind of go like this, that it's not the cold. You know, you get the cold and your nose gets stuffed up and your mucus changes and, you know, you can't smell, and then you get better from the cold and then you get your sense of smell back, right? That's what happens to all of us. And it's pretty clear now that's not what this virus is doing. This virus is doing something totally different that's kind of changing our ways of thinking about what's important when we, you know, to the function of our ability to smell. And as Dave kind of mentioned, you know, the thing that we initially thought was that maybe the virus goes up into your nose and infects a part of your nasal cavity called the olfactory epithelium. I'll try to keep the longish words to a minimum, but it's like a part of the inside of your nose that's responsible for detecting odors, responsible for smelling. And, you know, really I'm a neurobiologist, right? So like I care about the brain, I care about neurons and process information. And that's what, you know, wakes me up in the morning. And the olfactory epithelium is filled with these neurons, which are just like the cells in your brain, except they live in your nose. And these neurons are responsible for sensing smells in the world. So you take a sniff, right? You get all these small molecules that are volatile, that are coming off of your food, they're coming off of everything in your environment. Yeah, they come into your nose and they interact with these neurons in your nose. And then your neurons, you're going to love this, these neurons actually communicate with your brain because they have these little bits of wiring, which are called axons, that actually poke through holes in the base of your skull. So you have these tiny little holes that like separate your nose. You know, you have this bone that separates your nose from your brain, right? To prop the front of your brain up and not let it fall into your mouth. And into that little bone, which is called the cribriform plate, there are like a bunch of these little holes. And this wiring goes from the neurons in your nose through these holes in your skull into your brain, basically. And so like the initial idea was, well, maybe what's happening is the virus is coming in, you're getting infected, and that virus is infecting these sensory neurons, which are responsible for smell, messing up the neurons, and that's why we all lose our sense of smell. It looks like that idea is not true. It looks like instead, there are other sorts of cells that kind of prop up and feed the olfactory sensory neurons in your nose. And these are the support cells that Dave was mentioning. And it looks like the
sustentacular,
the spectacular sustentacular cell. And it looks like those are the primary cells that are getting infected. That's what it seems. At least, you know, everything's subject to revision. This is science. Like there's no dogma here. But the data that we have currently, both in animals and in humans, is that like when you get infected, these support cells that are they're responsible for kind of maintaining your olfactory sensory neurons get infected. And then there's probably some local inflammatory process that effectively shuts down the ability of your sensory neurons to work. And so you kind of like a light switch, lose your sense of smell when the sustentacular cells stop working. And then when the infection clears, for most people, right, the sustentacular cells get better, the local inflammation goes away, and all of a sudden your sensory neurons start working again. And now all of a sudden you can smell.
It's better news that it's not messing with the neurons, right?
Yeah, it's definitely in most people. But David, you know, one of the things to keep in mind is that there is this relatively large fraction of people that lose their smell for longer. And we think in those cases, the neurons are probably being messed with. That like denied support from the support cells for a while, if the support cells are really hit hard, the neurons go on to die. You know, that can cause a prolonged sense of you know, loss of your sense of smell, but it also creates other issues. We talked just a little bit about parosmias, right? So anosmia is the loss of smell. Parosmia, as Ariel was describing, is when different smells smell wrong, and they often smell really funky and unpleasant. So you'll smell a flower and it'll smell like sewage, for example, which is horrible. And actually, when you have parosmias, you know, lots of patients who have parosmias now have trouble finding something to eat. And so we don't
That's why we're here, because we have a bunch of people asking how to fix this or what's going on. They want to know.
Yeah. So as I started, like, if we know little about how COVID causes anosmia, we know even less about how COVID causes parosmias, but there are some ideas. So one interesting idea comes from the third type of cell that's in your olfactory epithelium. So there's these neurons that detect odors, there's these support cells, there's a third kind of cell called a stem cell. So in me and in you and in everyone, when we breathe in and out, what we're basically doing is breathing in a bunch of garbage in the air, right? Pollutants, pollen, viruses, particulates, cigarette smoke, toxins, like just like day in, day out, this olfactory epithelium is bombarded with all sorts of toxic trash. And the reason why we have nose hairs and we have mucus is to like help prevent that crap from, you know, damaging our neurons. But inevitably our neurons are damaged and actually they die just as part of the normal wear and tear of your olfactory epithelium. So there are these special cells called stem cells that actually rebuild the epithelium when it's damaged. So they regenerate neurons. Now, that process kicks into high gear when a virus like the coronavirus, you know, really damages your olfactory epithelium. So what has to happen in order for that neuron, that new neuron that was just made to repair your epithelium, what has to happen for that thing to work? Well, you have a new neuron, it's born in your nose, so obviously it has to be able to detect odors, but also it has to send one of those wires up through one of those holes in your brain, in your skull, and it has to go to just the right place in your brain. And so that's hard. Like there's a huge distance between your nose and this part of the brain that like that information has to go to. And so it takes a long time for that process to actually occur. And then often when the wiring, the axon enters the brain, at the beginning, it's actually in the wrong place. And so one idea about parosmias is that it actually reflects a process of repair and recovery. Your neurons are getting rebuilt, they're getting rewired, and you know that information is going to the brain, but it's not quite going to the right place. And confronted with this kind of weirdness, your brain turns that into like a nasty smell. And the idea is that over time, the wiring will refine itself, and the axons will increasingly go to the right places, and then the parosmias will go away and you'll recover your sense of smell. So that's just one idea. There's probably more going on than we know, but that's the current predominant theory.
Wait, so the theory is eventually your brain will integrate it in the same way that it used to, or you'll just get used to the new integration and you'll tell yourself that it doesn't smell like gasoline anymore. It smells like whatever.
We think it probably is going back to the way it was before, but part of what's definitely happening, and this kind of touches on what we can do to help patients, right? Part of what's happening probably is also your brain is relearning, you know, what smells are. And so, you know, I don't know if you heard about this thing, but like the one clinical thing that has, you know, some evidence to support it, to help with folks who are anosmic, hyposmic, meaning they have kind of less of a sense of smell, or parosmic after COVID infections, is this thing called smell training, where basically you take a bunch of purified or essential oils. And there are a lot of websites actually online that can help kind of guide you through this process. There's one particularly good one called Abscent, A-B-S-C-E-N-T, that sells kits and has guides for how to do this. Basically, you smell various smells or essential oils, you know, throughout the day, whose identity is known to you. So you smell lavender, you smell peppermint, you smell this, you smell that, and you just remind yourself, oh, this is peppermint, this is lavender, you know, this is apricot, this is peach, and you just do that over and over and over again. And it's thought through this kind of repeated smell training, your brain relearns what smells are, and helps to reintegrate the new information as it's coming in from your nose, as your nose repairs itself.
Harold, did you do something like that when it happened to you? When you want to talk about your story about going through this pre-COVID?
Yeah, it was very different because, I mean, it was similar in the sense that I woke up one morning, I made myself a cup of coffee, and after a minute or so realized that I actually wasn't smelling it. I was tasting it, but I wasn't getting any of the pleasant smells. And then I noticed through the rest of the day that I wasn't smelling anything. And that lasted for several weeks. And I didn't have any symptoms. I didn't have a cold. Everything else seemed normal. So that was scary because I was in the middle of writing a book about smells. And so I got in touch with friends of mine at the Monell Chemical Senses Center in Philadelphia, you know, asking them what could I do. And they basically said at the time, and this is maybe 6-7 years ago, just hang in there. And usually it comes back, but sometimes it doesn't, and you won't know until it does or doesn't. And I didn't actually think of training, you know, trying to exercise those muscles because I didn't really know what was going on. So I just, you know, crossed my fingers, and it was a really unpleasant few weeks because I wasn't getting any pleasure from food, except, you know, taste. And so I was, you know, upping the hot sauce in everything just to get some kind of sensation. And stopped going out to restaurants because there was no point, stopped drinking wine, because there are cheaper ways to enjoy alcohol. And even just, you know, walking into my house or going out of my house, you know, and you get a blast of fresh air and you kind of, you know, just get a sense of the environment. All that was gone. It was really upsetting. So anyway, I lucked out. Yeah, it came back eventually and gradually. It's not a nice experience.
Well, you say you didn't train, but I remember I saw you, like, we hung out like when you were coming out of it at one point. I forget what we were doing, and you were doing kind of A/B testing. You were talking. You were making mental notes of what something smelled like before versus now. I mean, you probably didn't even notice it, but that's kind of like the way that you operate. So maybe, you know, your natural way of being was helpful in terms of helping you get your smell back. Because I remember you being like, you know, bring it up, look, take it down, bring it up. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I was certainly testing myself every day and multiple times during the day, hoping, you know, for some sign that something was coming back. And I would try everything, you know, bad smells, good smells, but I wasn't, you know, smelling something and then thinking that smell, you know, trying to make the association. I was just, it was kind of an A/B test in the sense of, is it there or not? And does it smell right or not?
Yeah. All right, and then not to freak the listeners out, even more, but I saw a study that says that more people have olfactory deficits as a result of COVID than they know. In other words, that the odds that you have a deficit and don't know that you've been somewhat impacted are quite high. Is that accurate?
Yeah, absolutely. People are really lousy at, believe it or not, reporting their own kind of self-sense of smell, right? They're not really good at that. So if you ask folks, you know, the prevalence of COVID-associated, you know, changes in smell are like at 60-65%. But if you test them, it's more like 80s. And as more objective testing kind of makes its way into the world, you know, given the pandemic, you know, that number could even rise. So yeah, I think it's people's lack of self-insight into their sense of smell that might be underrepresenting how badly the virus is really infecting this particular sense.
And lastly, on this kind of like nuts and bolts aspect of it, I saw some data that country by country, the reported rates are different, but that's probably almost certainly just the way it's being reported, right?
Yeah, and actually, you'll get a kick out of this. You know, initially, a lot of the reports had women getting anosmia much more than men, but that's just because women are much more insightful about their sense of smell than men are. When you objectively test them, they're basically the same.
Really?
Yeah. So the initial part, people were really wondering whether there was a sex difference.
But it was like 30-60, right? The original data was like 30-60.
Yeah. I mean, that all washes out with objective testing.
That's really interesting. And like what you said before about people not being good at reporting their own like decline in smell sensitivity. I mean, it definitely jibes with like what I've experienced training people to do sensory analysis and the sort of like general, one paper put it as humans are extraordinarily good at distinguishing smells, but extraordinarily bad at describing smells. Although that's generally linked to like experience and culture. So, the difference in men and women makes me think, you know, since perfume and like scented body products are marketed so heavily to women, like maybe culturally they tend to be, you know, more trained and attuned to noticing these like differences in smell.
Well, so speaking of that, Ariel, and testing, so Mike Bastman wants to know what are the objective tests that they use rather than just your subjective perception of it?
Well, I mean, you know, technically speaking, no perception is truly subjective. I mean, it's going to vary person by person, but like for the most part, a glass of wine is not going to smell subjectively to somebody like a cheeseburger. So, which I know I am, you know, belaboring a sort of pedantic point, but I don't know how they test in a medical context in doing a sensory analysis of wine or whiskey cocktails or rum, which is what I've done. I mean, we train people not in the ability to physically smell things, but in the ability to name the smells that they're smelling, and we always do that with physical references. So if they say celery, we give them some, you know, fresh celery, celery seed, dried celery, and they have to tell us which one aligns with what they mean when they say celery, for example.
Yeah, one of the studies I saw was actually using the commercially available smells of the nez du vin.
Oh yeah, le nez du vin.
Those things stank.
Well, I mean, if you're smelling smell molecules in concentrations that like no human is really supposed to or finds in nature. But yeah, the nez du vin is one example of trying to standardize these references because it's based on like specific blends of molecules.
Well, I know there's some researchers who are trying to come up with smell kits for people to test themselves at home in a more objectively verifiable way based on kind of easy to purchase odorants.
Yeah.
Any of you guys like?
I've heard of that. I mean, I'm just spitballing here, so Sandeep, please correct me if I'm like talking outside my discipline too much. It sounds like it could be kind of analogous to like testing for concussions, where it's like much better to have a baseline reading or baseline test to compare to, rather than trying to figure out from scratch like post trauma if something has happened.
You know, that's completely true. You know, my buddy Noam Sobel at the Weizmann Institute came up with a kind of clever solution to this, which is he wrote up a phone-based app where you just go into your kitchen and you pick five kind of canonical smells. And he has a long list of like 100 you can pick from. You just have to find five of them. Toothpaste is one of them, I think. Not that that's my kitchen. And then you just measure your perception of them longitudinally.
Yeah.
And so it's thought that like it's the delta, it's the change that
right.
really is indicative. Because, you know, human perception, as I'm sure you're aware, is so varied and so individualized.
Absolutely.
That, you know, what's normal for me is very different from what's normal for you. And so this kind of longitudinal testing ends up being really important.
Very cool.
All right. So you talked a little bit about, well, we'll go this one first on treatment. So Jim wanted to know, other than steroids and platelet stuff, is there any thoughts on stem cell therapy for fixing this problem in the future? Like how many years away are they from being able to fix this like that way?
Well, you know, like I said, there are stem cells in your nose that repair your epithelium. And so people have long been fascinated with that because a thing that maybe you guys don't know is that, or maybe you do know, right, is that like your brain isn't very good at repairing itself precisely because it doesn't have very many stem cells. There's a very small population of stem cells in your hippocampus, for example. But that's basically it, except for your nose, which continuously regenerates these neurons. And so people have actually been taking nose tissue and like putting it in damaged spinal cords, for example, to try to see whether the stem cells from your nose can rebuild other parts of your nervous system. My buddy Brad Goldstein at Duke has actually done this for smell in animal models. So you can damage the olfactory epithelium of a mouse, and then you can transplant back into that mouse some new olfactory stem cells. It turns out that works. It actually repairs the epithelium. As far as I know, this has never been tried in a human, and so this kind of work is going to be several years off before it'll help us. But it's a thing that, in principle, could work, and I think it's a subject of active research.
How many years do you guys, this is not related to COVID, how many years until like the average high school student can CRISPR themselves up and turn themselves into a glow-in-the-dark rave party person?
I mean, I know a guy that sells kits for that.
You know, it's coming.
I'd wait. I don't know. I'd wait.
Yeah, I haven't tried it. I just,
I mean, if I was going to CRISPR myself, it would be a glow-in-the-dark, like, huge, like, patch right in the middle of my forehead, so I wouldn't need to worry about a headlamp, and then when everyone turns the lights down, I'll still be able to see. You know what I mean?
There's an artist, I'm going to look up his name, who made a rabbit glow-in-the-dark somehow.
Dave, if I could CRISPR and photosynthesis into you, you wouldn't take that?
Right? I like eating so much. I mean, I don't need sugar injected, you know, into me, you know. And then I don't know. I mean, it would be a good use of my extra carbon dioxide. And Nastasia tells me I have enough of it, right?
Yeah.
All right. And I'm gonna want a specific answer to this. Nicole wrote in. I know we've touched on it, but do they have any information on the frequency of full versus partial recovery, and does it come back the same? She's personally panicked and dying to know.
My understanding is that when people recover, they feel pretty normal, and I think the data are still emerging about rates of recovery and the nature and the course of the recovery. I mean, we've only been in this pandemic for a year, and I'll just remind you, like, this is the biggest olfactory crisis perhaps humanity has ever faced. I realize it sounds kind of ridiculous, but it's true.
No, it's totally true.
Right? I mean, new onset anosmia is extremely rare, right? And so now all of a sudden we're just confronted with this, and we're learning about it as we go.
Well, the question I have then is, like, also, you know, because this disease is also impacting, you know, people, like, for instance, in nursing homes disproportionately, and they have trouble typically eating and enjoying what's going on anyway. Are we going to see more people dying from lack of nutrition over the next, like, year because they just don't want to eat anymore and they're already in a compromised position?
Yeah, I mean, there's really three things here. One is that smell is essential to sense danger, right? So, there's actually a family of nine, I think, in Texas, where eight of them were anosmic and there was a fire in the house and none of them noticed, except for the one person who wasn't anosmic who dragged the other eight out. So, like, that's a real thing. The nutrition thing is absolutely an issue. It's an issue, you know, as you get older, as you were just kind of implying, you know, people begin to lose their sense of smells and sense of smell. And if you look at people in their 80s, lots of them are functionally anosmic. And that goes with a change in nutritional status. I actually want to focus on a thing that Harold was bringing up. You know, he was describing his personal experience with anosmia, and basically he was describing feeling blue. And I think lots of people who have lost their sense of smell have that sense that they're kind of floating in the world and a little bit emotionally out of sorts. And that is, in a sense, to be expected. Your sense of smell is very directly connected to the emotional and memory centers in your brain. And when people lose their sense of smell, it's actually a known risk factor for depression. And so for your listeners, I really want to emphasize that if that's how you're feeling, it's like kind of expected. It's part of what happens to people when they lose their sense of smell, and you should seek help. I think one of the things that the medical community is going to face is a lot of depression that's related to people with prolonged loss of their sense of smell. And it's important to be really aware of that and sympathetic to that.
Speaking of going back to age and training and sense of smell in general, so if training helps you with COVID-related, loss of smell, whether entire or partial, could training help everyone as they're getting older to train their nose to constantly be aware? Is being aware of smells around you going to keep your sense of smell longer? Is there any data on this?
I don't know of any data. Ariel, do you know any data?
No, I was just trying. I mean, it's a super intriguing question. I was just trying to think of if I knew any papers that talk about that.
I don't know any specifically, but I do remember reading that, in fact, you can, to some extent, improve older people's what acuity or just, you know, appreciation of that sense by getting them to use it in a kind of focused, conscious way. Mm. So I think there have been studies like that done. I don't know how big, how long ago, but yeah, I think I'm certainly thinking as I turn 70 that I'm going to be exercising my sense of smell as much as I can.
Well, because I know there's data on cognition, right? People who like relatively challenge their brains like tend to keep their cognition in better shape longer, right? So maybe same is true for smells. Who knows, right?
Yeah, I mean it's totally reasonable. And actually, you know, the part of your central brain that's responsible for processing smells and assigning them to perception and maybe helping you make decisions based upon smells, that part of your brain is super plastic. It's really, really flexible. And so I can imagine that working it out would be really helpful as you get older.
Just Egg is now the fastest growing egg brand in the United States. Bring more plant-based consumers in your doors with easy-to-use Just Egg. You can get started with a free sample. Just head to ju.st/HRN. That's ju.st/HRN. Made from plants, Just Egg is a better egg for you and for the planet. It's healthier, with no cholesterol and less saturated fat, and it's more sustainable. Just Egg uses less water and generates fewer carbon emissions. Most importantly, it's delicious. For our listeners who operate a food service establishment, you can get a sample for free. Head to ju.st/HRN. That's ju.st/HRN. Just Egg makes a delicious plant-based addition to any menu. It's available as a liquid scramble, great for omelets, frittatas, stir fries, and French toast. There's also a frozen pre-baked folded version that's ideal for filling breakfast sandwiches or topping salads. Chef Jose Andres calls Just Egg mind-blowing, and Bon Appetit says, it's so good, I feel guilty eating it. Put the fastest-growing egg brand on your menu. Get a free sample of Just Egg for your restaurant at ju.st/HRN. Are you longing for a trip to Mexico? Do you want to taste mezcal straight out of a wood-fired clay pot still at a palenque in Puebla? Well, we can't help you with that, but we can offer the next best thing, Agave Road Trip in a Box. This set of 10 samples of rare heritage agave spirits will transport your heart with the warmth of liquid Mexico. Get your set at agavefestival.org and then join Agave Road Trip podcast co-hosts Chava and me, Lou, for an online tasting. Agavefestival.org is the break you've been looking for, or as close as you're going to get.
All right, now I'm going to read the question that started it all, and then you guys can have at it. We've talked around it, but the reason I decided to have you all was we got a question from Jill Kubica via email. I'm sure I mutilated your last name. I apologize, Jill. Okay, my friend is about 3 months post-COVID, and suddenly a new devastating side effect has surfaced, parosmia. It started when he thought his jar of peanut butter had suddenly horribly gone rancid. So this is later. And by the way, I'll say also, my wife, Jen, now every once in a while has like what she calls like flashback phantom smells, where she smells gasoline all of a sudden for no reason, nowhere near a gas thing. It started when he thought his jar of peanut butter has gone horribly rancid. Over the next 48 hours, many other foods he encountered also exhibited this rancidity. Several others with this after effect have been described have described their new taste encounters to be horrendous mixes of feces and rotting garbage. Have been advised by doctors that this could potentially last up to years. Now, right there, she's making me think sulfurous compounds, right? Feces, garbage, sulfurous, and nitrogen compounds.
Well,
right?
I was going to say... keep reading, because also nitrogen, but you...
Yeah. Here is a list of foods that trigger this smell for my friend. Anything with nuts, alliums, garlic, and onions. So there's your sulfur, right? Mm-hmm. Meat that is breaded, which is interesting. Breaded meat. Grilled, blackened, or fried meats, I guess, or foods. Chocolate. And acidic candy, which isn't particularly aromatic, which is interesting. Things that do not trigger dumpster mouth, which is, I guess, a good term. Can you guys use that professionally going forward, dumpster mouth? You have to give it to Jill, though. Like, you have to, you know, quote her as dumpster mouth. Things that do not trigger the dumpster mouth, salmon, sausages, donuts, bagels, thank goodness. By the way, if we have time, which we won't, Bill de Blasio toasting his bagel. I mean, you could toast a bagel at home if you like, but you're the mayor of New York. What? I mean, come on, people. You're the mayor of New York City. Come on. You don't eat pizza with a fork here. You don't want to. Come on.
It is one of the ceremonies of state that you have to observe, regardless of personal preference, if you're the
Yeah, he's like, I want a whole wheat bagel with extra cream cheese toasted. You're like, you're the mayor of New York. No, you don't. No, you don't.
Everything God. Untoasted scallion, obviously.
I mean, geez, Louise. Anyway, so tomato soup and most dairy. My friend would like to get back to enjoying meals and keep the nausea / vomiting to a minimum. This has been affecting both his physical and mental health, as we were saying, mental health. Is there anything you can find or think of that's similar in process or chemical makeup amongst the trigger foods that he can avoid, or any research you can find to help someone suffering from this redevelop their sense of taste? Thanks in advance. And for Nastasia's notes, Jill is 30, female, single, and a home cook that has almost no gadgets but still enjoys food science and restaurant industry shop talk. Nice. She's a former server. And I'm going to piggyback on what you're going to answer for this and also say, is there any relation between this kind of taste and smell transference and what happens to some women when they're pregnant and smells that were formerly fine are now intolerable?
That's an interesting question. I don't have an answer for that right now. But, I mean, Harold, Dave mentioned this. Harold, let me know if this stood out to you, too. Like, immediately, I mean, obviously a lot of these nasty smells come from the Maillard reaction, especially in the like breaded grilled meat, you know, and then the alliums, that's obviously like a sulfur thing. I was stuck a little on the nuts, but the nuts have like tons of pyrazines in them, so I mean it makes me immediately think like sulfur and nitrogen heteromolecules. You know, we mentioned flowers earlier, those can have indoles, which have nitrogen, and aminoacetophenone, which also have nitrogen. I mean, just from my own like lab work, I know that we humans tend to have like very low thresholds to many sulfur and nitrogen compounds. So they are molecules that we're already pretty physiologically sensitive to already. Was my like initial takeaway.
Ariel, you know, there's been a little bit of work done formally now exploring this hypothesis that there are specific odorous triggers for parosmia. And you have it exactly right. So mazel tov.
Thank you.
That's exactly the conclusion of the paper, which is that sulfurs and nitrogens are the things that are driving it. And actually the fact that there are specific triggers is precisely why we think we have an incomplete understanding of what's going on with parosmia. If it was just like miswiring and regeneration of your olfactory system, you might imagine that should affect all smells equally or in kind of some equally distributed way. But the fact that, like, you know, sulfurs and nitrogens are the culprits mainly. Coffee is a big offender. Lots of people can no longer.
Coffee famously, I mean, obviously a lot of like nitrogen, pyrazines, and pyridines from the Maillard reaction, but like some of the main odorants are like sulfur containing furanones from cysteine.
Yeah, well, like the well-known, if it doesn't have the skunk, it doesn't smell fresh. You remove the skunk from coffee, and it doesn't smell fresh anymore. True story, people. One question I had real quick, sorry. So, Bob, the training before, does that also, if you keep smelling smells that smell like dumpsters, does that help rewire your brain to have them not smell like dumpster anymore?
Yeah, I don't know about that, actually. I think the smell training has always been focused on pleasant things. So I think that's actually a really good question. And it's worth wondering whether or not people can habituate to the dumpster smells, right? That's also an important question worth asking.
Yeah, I mean, like adults can habituate to like epoisse cheese, so.
Harold can habituate to surstromming.
I was just going to mention that I think the paper that Bob is referring to on MedArchive from the UK that actually took coffee apart into its components and then had people suffering post-COVID smell the individual components. And sure enough, it's the sulfur compounds and the pyrazines that they respond to. But the other weird thing that this paper reported is that a number of people in their study find the smell of excrement not excremental. It's kind of, you know, biscuity, I think, is the term that they used. and they found that those people did not respond to indole, scatol, both of which are nitrogen compounds, and or to cresol, which are the main components in smelly components in excrement. So it's really puzzling and complicated.
Wait, but they normally could smell poop as poop, but post COVID now poop is biscuit.
That's right. Yeah. So dumpster is maybe not the right term, because good things smell dumpsterish, but dumpster itself smells nice.
Well, I mean, since feces is mostly dead bacteria, I wonder if there's some kind of, like, you know, when you age champagne on lees, you get that like biscuity smell. I wonder if maybe people are just smelling like cellular proteolysis.
And is that biscuity smell related to the mushroomy smell? Mushroomy taste?
I mean, mushroomy would probably be from like an 8-carbon aldehyde or ketone, and biscuity. I mean, that biscuity is often also aldehydes, but like smaller ones, just off the top of my head.
Let's hit some of these more questions. This is not COVID related, but from Dylan Hoyer. You did an interview on Heritage Herald that left Dylan wondering, if smells are created from pre-existing molecules, can we ever create truly new smells?
Well, I think that's something that people are making concerted efforts at and have been for a long time, especially in the perfume business, where, you know, people are trying to come up with molecules that are, you know, cheaper to make than extracting natural components, but give something like a similar effect. And there are molecules that perfumers use that are said to smell like the seaside, like the ocean, a single molecule, not the ensemble that you actually get when you do go to the ocean, but a single molecule that kind of captures that whole experience. So I would say yes.
But I wonder whether Dylan meant also, like, what does it mean to have something be new? Like, how can you dream of something you've never experienced in the real life? You know what I mean?
Yeah. And that's different. How we would perceive a molecule that our olfactory receptors can detect, but have not detected before.
Mm.
That's a good question, how we would respond to that.
Well, and I think maybe on top of novel molecules, since mixtures of molecules, I mean, can take on like synergistic qualities, it's probably possible to make a mixture of molecules that you smelled before that smells like nothing you've ever smelled before.
Man, just integrates just, differently?
Yeah, I mean, because you process... Okay, so you process like individual odor molecules as like an odor image, like a spatial activation of, I want to say, and apologies, I'm not a neuroscientist, glomeruli, brain cells on the olfactory bulb.
brain cells,
and it makes a spatial pattern. Anyways, so if you smell a lot of molecules at once, it also makes a pattern. So your brain just like remembers that pattern. So things like things like chocolate or lavender or wine, like there's no one molecule in them that smells like that. It's a like blended and possibly synergistic thing. This makes me think back to there's a paper a few years ago about olfactory white. So, you know, there's like white noise and white color, which is like both of them are made by like mixing a lot of, wavelengths. And they were trying to make mixtures of odorants that smelled the smell equivalent of white noise. It's been a while since I read it, and I don't think in the paper itself they listed what was in the mixtures, but it always made me wonder if like people were smelling that thing over and over again, was it the unfamiliarity that made it like a white smell or something inherent in it? Because generally like things that you sense or smell more often like take on more nuance to you. And so by that, I mean, like, that could be an example of making a mixture of things you have smelled that creates a truly new smell, at least to you.
Speaking of neutral white, Ariel, mm-hmm. is there, or does anyone here know of, like, so like Jimmy McAcid, you take it, it knocks out your sense of sweet. Is there like a, is there a temporary smell knockout other than just holding your nose? Is there actually like some sort of like, you can take something and experience this for like half of an hour without fear of being permanent, or no?
Not that I know of, but.
Dave, I would kill for such a thing. If there just isn't, I would love to be able to like, you know, turn on and off the olfactory system at will, and that's not a problem that's been solved.
Yeah.
Yeah. Besides, right. I mean, we just use nose clamps, but.
Yeah, but that's, you know.
It's not perfect. Yeah.
Yeah, it's just diminishing. Yeah, yeah. Andrew Hyatt wants to know, I'm curious on thoughts on how to improve the ability to distinguish smells, picking out notes in wine, for example. So this dovetails, I guess, with the training, but any specific advice? Anyone?
I can jump in. Yeah, I mean, like, really, and, you know, Harold touched on this too, it's really just about practice. I mean, you know, there is, like, natural variation in sensitivity. People express different amounts of different olfactory receptors in their olfactory epithelium, their nose. You know, that's sort of a baseline, but I haven't read any like empirical data on this. I'm pretty convinced that most people who like work very creatively with smell, whether that's like perfumers or sommeliers or chefs and stuff like that, much more about like what you choose to pay attention to than any sort of like innate sensitivity. And so, I mean, in terms of like specific advice, I usually just, sometimes I steal ideas from like sensory science and sensory descriptive analysis, which is literally just like smell four different versions of like celery or grass or chocolate and like pay attention to the differences. And, you know, other than that, just like smell as many things as you can and pay attention to what you're smelling. And it's really just, I found like a process of time. I mean, you know, I like professionally work on food and smell now. But when I started out when I started grad school at like 22, I was in the wine department at UC Davis, and you know, I signed up as a panelist for some of these sensory analysis things, and I like I could not smell oak. Like, I could not detect oak in wine. It did not like exist for me. And then after like maybe a month of like smelling the same samples every day, it all of a sudden like slid into focus. It's like, oh, that's oak.
Hey, you can't leave UC Davis without being a steel tankhead, right? This is oak and you hate it, right? Is that what they do? This is oak and you hate it. That's UC Davis, no? In a nutshell, or
it depends. Yeah. Sometimes it's oak chips. No, actually, I have a couple of people in my lab are specifically studying the flavor chemistry of oak barrels and like what got extracted into wine at like different toast levels and stuff. But,
toast levels.
Yeah.
Bob, do you do any trigeminal stuff up at the Harvard or no?
No, we don't. Others do, but yeah. But it's important to consider in all this because it looks like taste and hemostasis are also affected by the virus, right?
Right. So, like,
I've heard that, yeah.
I don't know. So, trigeminal, by the way, to D-word salad, pain foods.
Well, pain and touch foods, because it's like astringency is trigeminal also.
Right. So, yeah. Here's a question that I'm going to throw at you guys. This is why I asked. I dealt with it a little bit last week, but Spencer Roberts wants to know about Szechuan peppercorns. They blow his taste buds out, right?
Hmm.
So, the question is there any way to speed up tamping that down? I know it's a different set of receptors than do with, you know, deal with capsaicin, but like, is there a way to kind of unnumb yourself at a fast rate? Is there a milk equivalent?
Well, I've never made an effort to find something like that, and I'm not aware of any. An odd set of sensations that you get from Szechuan peppercorn, and so I think there's a lot of interest in it, and you know, figuring out what ion channels are being hit and that kind of thing. But when it comes to dealing with it practically, I haven't seen any information about how to, you know, extract the compounds from your from your tissues faster than otherwise.
I think a lot of, or for the most part, people eat, you know, Sichuan pepper or mala food specifically for that sensation. Because they want to have it for a while. But
Harold, maybe you know the latest. You know, I thought that like sensual hit potassium channels, right? And inhibited neural transmission as a consequence. So you could probably actually screen for an antagonist for an antagonist of that effect if you wanted, right? So if someone was really eager to reverse their sensual mouth and had several million dollars in a lab, I think it's an achievable goal. I'm not certain anyone would do it, but I think it's achievable.
Well, Bob, maybe you could do it. Maybe you could do it for me.
Maybe.
By the way, I know this is like totally a cheap shot, but like I like some flavored oils, right? Ones that weren't overused in the early 90s, I like, right? So like, obviously I can't deal with truffle oil just because you used to walk into a restaurant in the 90s and it was like, boom, oh Jesus. But like, I like, and it's probably all fake, I like the different Sichuan peppercorn oils, both green and red. It's an easy way to cheat that flavor if you want to like dose it, because you can't buy decent actual Sichuan peppercorn easily, and then it's so hard to dose and it changes over time. If you use the oil, it's easy peasy. Am I a bad person? For that reason?
Yeah, I was like, wait, what?
I mean, no, right?
You no, can use I don't, that stuff. I don't think you're a bad person. I don't know how they make it. I wouldn't imagine that they'd use like purified hydroxy alpha sansiol the way that they use like that one, whatever ketone or something from truffles to make fake truffle oil. But you could always check you could check the label. And if the label says like natural flavors instead of Sichuan peppercorn, then that's a hint.
There's not a lot that I can understand on the label. You know what I mean? It's not one of those situations. Uh-huh. You know what I mean? It's not one of those stitches. So Ariel, while I have you here, here's two quick ones for you. This, you're perfect for it. I don't know why they wanted my thoughts on it. They really want your thoughts.
Got time for like one, two more.
I don't know who it was. Came from the chat room, I think, last week. I came across a blog post about creating quick garums by using freeze-dried pancreas to accelerate the enzymatic activity, and was curious about someone's thoughts on it. How about yours, since they're actually informed?
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, I saw that question. My friend Jason White, who's taken over the NOMA fermentation lab after David Zilber, after me and Lars, was experimenting with that a few years ago. I think he was using actual like whole pancreas, but I did not. I don't think I got a taste of what he was doing, but I mean, he was saying it worked like super fast.
Pancreas.
I think we need a different name for that than garum. I mean, even what people like, garum kind of makes sense like internally or like as like one example to call these like proteolized protein sauces. But for the most part, like garum and liquamen were these Roman fish sauces, actually, like very close to nom plat. And those you get funky and umami flavors from letting the digestive tracts of fish essentially digest and proteolize the tissue of fish. So you let it sit for a very long time with a lot of salt, and the proteins turn into free amino acids, and there's lots of smells too. So most of the like neo-garums that people are making now, they don't actually use fish digestive enzymes. They're using koji. That's like a Japanese Aspergillus oryzae inoculated moldy rice that has a lot of proteolytic enzymes.
It's a mold.
That's already like a step away from garum. It's probably actually closer to like the original Chinese jiang that first used some of these mold starters. Anyways, so if you're going to a step further to pancreas dissolving protein, I don't know, maybe that does take it a step closer to original garum. But yeah, I mean, I think the interesting takeaway with that, if you can get the pancreas or the enzymes, is usually those fermentations take like a year or two at room temperature. At NOMA, we would speed them up in like a 60 degree Celsius room, and it would take about 12 weeks. So you'd get a lot of like browning reactions with that, just from the time and the free amino acids and sugars. But I know that the pancreas enzymes, you can do it in like a couple days.
But it's nothing that happens in a couple of days tastes the same as something that happens over
months. Yeah, true. But what I'm saying is that it's like a a different thing with different potential to optimize flavor wise.
Yeah, right.
Which is cool. Like, it doesn't need to be the old thing. It's a new thing. But it's cool that other people are trying out some of the stuff that Jason was experimenting with.
Yeah, and then quickly, what? All right, well, real quickly, Ariel, real quick, okay. Super quick. Difference between a sweet mash and sour mash, introduced acidity to keep bacteria production down. Brian Leonza wants to know. We're probably too late, but.
Wait, okay, yeah, sorry, I'm just looking at this question. Sour mash uses introduced acidity to keep bacteria production down. Isn't it bacteria that produces the sour mash? Like, isn't it like a lactic acid bacteria? It's been a long time since I actually
I would guess
this.
We'll have a whiskey we'll have someone who like worries about sour mash on.
Increased production of more varied bacteria responsible for an increase in different esters. I mean, it's possible. Like, so esters are like molecules that combine an organic acid with an alcohol. So like all fermented alcoholic beverages have a bunch of esters in them. And if you have like organic acids, which are also fatty acids, and alcohols around together, they will just spontaneously form, if you have high enough amounts of both, into esters. So I know this is important for rum. Some of the more like bacterial rum fermentations, like Jamaican rum, get super high esters this way. So it's definitely possible, but this would be a question deserving of a lit review that I have not done.
All right. Alex Staharsky wrote in. I'll get this one real quick. What are the differences chemically between white and pink grapefruit juice? Since white grapefruit juice is almost impossible to find now, is there a way to, via acid adjusting, to make pink grapefruit juice taste more like white? Thanks, Alex. So first of all, Alex, there's no such thing as just pink and white. There are different varieties. pink grapefruit is pink because there's lycopene in it. And when you clarify pink grapefruit juice, it goes yellow again. But it also turns out that the pink varieties that we typically get are bred to be sweeter and less acidic. So what you want is a smaller, typically more acidically, you want a variety, a cultivar that is more bred for acidity, something like a Duncan. So yeah, you can jack it with acid. I could try to look up what it is. I used to know off the top of my head what the acid balance in grapefruit was, but the color is just because of excess lycopene, which I think doesn't have much of a taste effect. Harold, Ariel, any thoughts on the taste effect of the pinkness?
Not offhand. No.
Yeah. I mean
it's a carotenoid.
Yeah.
And carotenoid breakdown products can be very lovely.
Yes.
And so it's possible that contributes in a kind of background way to the aroma of a pink grapefruit.
Agreed. Mm-hmm.
Fair. But in essence, also, they're bred to be, like, the ones that we get are bred to be sweeter, and so they're not going to have the high acidity for use in, like, cocktails like a Dunkin' would have, right? You know Dunkin's, anyway.
Wait, is white grapefruit impossible to find now? Like, I just saw some Oro Blancos at my...
Those are not the same, though. I mean, I think what Alex is talking about are the old-school, typically smaller, very tart grapefruits.
Oh, okay. Well, an Oro Blanco is like a... back cross back with a pomelo or something like that, I think.
Right. Yeah. It's a different Megillah.
Okay.
Whereas like
fair.
You can get them, but the thing is, you know, I mean, good grapefruits are, I think, difficult. You know, Nastasia had access to good grapefruits because your dad grows them, right, Stas?
Yeah, delicious. Ooh.
Yeah,
awesome.
They are delicious. I've had them. They're very good. And back when Jen, my wife Jen's dad, used to live in Arizona, he used to get amazing white grapefruits off of his tree, and I would just eat them by the bushel. But yeah, I think just most people don't want a sour variety anymore. And also, grapefruit quality really changes on storage, like a lot. And maybe the pink ones are better at holding some of their characteristics longer than some of the older variety white ones. I don't know. And maybe that's why you don't see them as often.
Well,
I don't know.
I mean, carotenoids can act as antioxidants, or like that's what they're evolved to do.
Oh, yeah. That's why Ronald Reagan says that ketchup is a healthy vegetable, right?
Lycopene, same thing.
Yeah.
I do. Sorry, this is not science related at all. I do just have to interject that, like, I mean, I'm a Northeasterner. I grew up in Boston and then like moved to New York. And like the thing that blew my mind the most when I moved to California for grad school was just that, like, oh yeah, I have a citrus tree in my backyard. And everyone treats that like it's totally normal. And it's like completely mind blowing.
Yeah, it's not normal.
to someone from that. I'm like, you can just go and pick a lemon? or a grapefruit, and I'm still incredibly jealous of that. But needed to shout out how like totally bizarre and wonderful that still is to me.
Nastassia left that to come back to this place.
Yeah, I mean, I guess she must like us a lot.
Yep, that is.
I don't know. I don't know about that. All right, so let's get our last licks in before Matt shuts us off. We'll go around the table. Any last COVID anosmia, like places to go, places to think, Bob? Anything? Any last licks you got here?
No, it's a good discussion. I just think this is a problem we don't understand. We got to keep working on.
Yeah. And, you know, you can follow Bob at, what has it? Is it data_lab?
It's just one word, datalab.org, with two T's.
Two T's. It's still the best name of any lab ever.
It's also my favorite character from Star Trek The Next Generation.
Oh, amen. Yeah. It's too bad that you decided to go into this and not like data science. Then you could have been like data lab, data scientist, data. Like, you could have been like all data all the time. But anyway, yeah, we'll have you back on to talk about the horrors of not paying your cryo bill and other fun things at some point. Bob, thanks so much for being on. Ariel, you got anything for me on the way out?
Oh, well, I mean, I as a person tend to harp on about paying more attention to smell, and you know, it's a shame that it's come in such a like distressing, you know, container, distressing like experiences for people, for this anosmia now. But it is like super fascinating that we, you know, Americans at least tend to think of smell as either like something that's kind of like dirty and gross, like you can smell garbage, or something that's like the pleasurability of it makes it frivolous. But it's just really cool in like a metaphysical way, to have this demonstration of like not only the important functionality of smell, but like how important the like hedonics and pleasure that we get from smell is for normal human functioning. And you know, that's a cool takeaway for people, even if you don't get anosmia.
Yeah. Harold, what do you got for me?
I would recommend that website that Bob mentioned, Absent, absent.org, which is based in the UK, and just lots of really good information about smell and problems with smell and things to do about problems with smell.
All right. And from the three of you, just as a takeaway for a too long didn't listen, like, it's terrible, you should get help, but it's 99% of the time it's going to come back. Is that accurate? Or it's most likely going to come back eventually? It might just take a long time?
You know,
am I being too rosy?
Yeah, I think the important thing, David, is there's no evidence at this point to suggest that it will not come back. So most people are getting better. Some people still have it even from the beginning of the pandemic. But at this point, we don't know what's going to happen. But there's no reason to think it's inevitably not going to come back. So people should keep up hope.
Ah, very spoken like a true doctor. There's no reason to think it won't come back. Spoken like a true doctor. This is why we have Bob on. Thanks, guys. Cooking Issues.
Cooking Issues is powered by Simplecast.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.